Thank you, David. It is, of course, a great privilege to do this. It's a difficult thing to do as well, because Gavin's only given me 5.5 minutes. But in some ways, that's useful, because if one just started talking about John, one would go on for an hour at least. So I've prepared just 5 minutes, and I'm going to constrain myself to the time that he was in the Lord's, as I will explain. So John Randall Palmer, the fourth Earl of Selborne, GBE, FRS, was born into a family that for 100 years had been involved in government. And although it was assumed that he would devote his life to running the family's very large horticultural and agricultural estate, it was no surprise that he was drawn into politics when he was at Oxford. But I don't have time to do justice to his long and fascinating life story. Instead, I refer you to the very excellent obituary that's on the website. I'm going to limit my remarks to John's career in the House of Lords, although I only met him in 2004 when I became the chairman of the Science and Technology Select Committee. He'd already been in the Lords for 32 years. He first sat in February 1972, after the death of his grandfather. His father had died in a military accident during the war. He was 32 years old, half the age of most in the House then, and it would be the same now. He delivered his maiden speech in July of 72 as a participant in a lengthy debate on a local government bill. He didn't follow the normal custom with maiden speeches of saying a few words about himself and staying away from controversy. He dived straight in and made a strong case for a much larger increase in the autonomy of local authorities than the bill was offering. And his speech drew compliments from all who followed him. For example, the Earl Waldegrave described it as an extremely able speech by all standards, and predicted, as many others did, that he would make an invaluable contribution to the work of the House of Lords. And so he did. He rapidly became an authority, if not the authority, on agricultural and horticultural affairs, and was dedicated to preserving the environment. He also understood the issues posed by our membership of the European Community. For instance, in 74, he sought to redress the damage done by French and Italian fruit growers who were, as he put it, planting irresponsibly well beyond the requirements of their own markets. At the same time, he pointed out that despite their actions, there was great optimism within the UK industry, and that insofar as apples are concerned, we could grow a commodity that was second to none. The apples he mentioned, of course, were Cox's and Bramley's. He had that happy way always of being a realist, but at the same time being optimistic. However, he was invariably modest about his knowledge and abilities, explaining that he was just a farmer. But of course, he was a very good and innovative farmer who made sure that he was up to date with the latest advances in science relating to farming. And farmers are anchored in reality, the results of their decisions and efforts clear for everyone to see, as they are, for example, for engineers and medical practitioners. It's difficult to balance the risks associated with innovation and change with the potential benefits they offer. He grew to understand this balance, and indeed to the importance of science and technology as it related to the whole of society. He had yet another skill that perhaps he is most famous for, and that was his ability as a chairman. His warmth and generosity and determination that everyone should contribute meant that people really enjoyed his chairmanship and gave of their best. Once again, he was very modest about this and would relate a story that I thought was probably not true and verified it beforehand, he would always say that Joanna said that he was mainly a good chairman because he had a loud voice. And he did have a loud and a clear voice. And what a marvelous thing it is to serve under a chairman of a committee when every word from the chair can be heard and understood. These meetings we knew very well, particularly when he was advising those who asked questions that if they limited themselves to 2 years, we would welcome it. This comprehensive expertise on how to organize and fund science and technological research and development, combined with his reputation as a first-class chairman, meant that by the 90s, he was in huge demand to lead inquiries and chair important committees. The list is long and impressive, as you can see in his obituary. I don't have time to mention it here. Notably, and he considered it one of his most important contributions, as David has said, he chaired the House of Lords Science and Technology Select Committee from 93 to 97, and again from 2014 through 2017, starting in 93 with an inquiry into the regulation of the United Kingdom biotechnology industry and global competitiveness, and ending more than a dozen inquiries later with one into connected and autonomous vehicles in 2017. He's the only person to chair the committee twice. Recognition of what he achieved gained him the highest rank amongst the Knights of the British Empire. And it was no surprise, of course, that he was an obvious choice to chair the Foundation for Science and Technology, as he had been working here, as it were, for many years beforehand. He took over when Lord Jenkin retired in 2006, and the foundation, of course, thrived and increased its influence under his chairmanship. Now, we all benefited from John's leadership, and his life is just not the same without his warmth, his friendship, and his support. We miss him terribly.